We did get one of these state innovation model grants, a significant one. We got $45 million over 3.5 years. It's a big deal for us, and it will really be the organizing framework for what we do over the next 3 years to make sure that we've created what we call a high-performance health system. Karen. So there's really three thrusts under this grant activity: advancing our payment reforms, using that platform of this giant network and the shared savings ACO to expand that model into Medicaid and into the commercial market. And we plan to do that during 2014. Also evolving that model so that it goes to two-sided risk as quickly as possible, perhaps quicker than the Medicare model. We also have some activity around bundled payments and some pay-for-performance in our Medicaid program that we're pursuing. But the big action is around that shared savings ACO model. Secondly, really building out and integrating our health information system. Not just expanding electronic health records to the remaining physicians in the state and creating interfaces between physicians and hospitals, but we're also looking at how to expand to community mental health centers and long-term care as part of the care continuum. And then delivery system transformation. Some of that is implied through the shared savings ACO, but I think you'll see a lot more deliberate activity in Vermont around health planning, how to make decisions as a state about what gets done where, and also expansion of the medical home so that there's sort of tighter connections with specialty care, because so far the focus has really been at the primary care level. And particularly around mental health, we know that we need to do some really intense work in improving the connections between the medical home and mental health care. Results so far, you know, I could claim we declare victory, but I won't. Some of the explicit decisions I can point to that we've made as a result of this regulatory structure are we told our hospitals that they could have 3% growth in their budgets. I did that without consulting Bob Reichauer. So they're supposed to give us budgets by July 1st that have a 3% rate of growth in them. We also are allowing them that's growth in their net patient revenues year over year. We're also allowing them a 1% investment if they make a good case for something that they think needs to be done in order to create greater efficiency or effectiveness over the long run. So health reform investments is what we're calling those. We've been scrutinizing health insurer rates for over a year now, but that whole world is about to change with the exchange. Vermont created one of two. I thought we were the only one, but I learned last night we're one of two states, us and DC, created an exchange where everybody has to go through it in the small group and non-group markets. And that's really going to change our rate review process a lot, make it simpler, we hope, and more understandable. And that's coming to us in June. And we're looking a lot more closely at insurer admin costs, both what are they spending on care management, and as we beef up our payment reforms, how much of that could we back out of premiums, insurer premiums. And even short of that, how much are they spending on things like prior authorizations, and what's the evidence that it's making any positive impact? So we're looking very closely at that. We have a bunch of payment reform pilots underway. I talked about expanding the shared savings model. And we're trying very hard to echo Uwe's point last night, trying very hard to make sure that Medicaid keeps up with cost inflation so that as we address sort of having an explicit constraint on healthcare costs, we also make sure there isn't this underpayment by Medicaid that necessitates a relief valve on the private side. I think I've covered most of that except for the single payer part, which is always the sexy part that gets people's attention. And I think it was even in the title of the session. Single payer is part of the governor's plan. But frankly, we have to do all this work before we can get there, and he acknowledges that. We need to control healthcare costs, make sure we can cover everybody at an affordable rate. He has to propose a financing plan that would replace private premiums with taxes, and he hasn't done that yet. He plans to do that in 2015. And then we need to ask the feds for a waiver from the ACA in order to implement that. So all of that is a couple years off. And in the meantime, Al and I will work hard to do the rest of it.
Good morning. Mike Minetto from Oregon, and I guess the first comment I wanted to make was in Oregon we take business casual very, very seriously. For those of you who know my boss, he wears cowboy boots and blue jeans, so we're always very comfortable without ties and jackets. So thank you for the opportunity. And my comments, I think, are really going to parallel what Anya was just saying. I think we certainly have a lot of similarities, you know, a few differences. I wouldn't put us into the single payer category, but definitely getting towards much more alignment, what we're calling really around the care model. One thing that Anya touched on, which I think is absolutely critical when you put yourself in a state's perspective, is that it's great to talk about the policy and the theory at a very, very high level. But the next step is, how do you take that and actually get it through a political process? And then how do you take it and actually implement it? And I think as a state, you know, you have to be thinking about those three buckets continuously. You can't just really live in that policy. You really have to think about it all the way through. So David Cutler started yesterday by saying you have to always start with a scary slide. And, you know, this is where I think the governor has been, you know, out in front for many, many years. I think he's probably one of the best national speakers of really kind of presenting the problem and then really kind of forcing people to really look at solutions. This is something that we started, you know, many years ago, just saying, listen, do you know what's in front of you? When we're talking with legislators or even with our healthcare industry stakeholders, saying you've got to change. You've got to really look at how you're going to change your business model before it's too late, before you have these draconian cuts coming. So this was always kind of front and center for us. The second piece for us was when Governor Kitzhaber was elected, this is now his third term, this is what we were faced with in terms of a budget deficit. So that top pink line are the projections in expenditures, the bottom blue line projections in state revenue. And that, at the time, for us, was a $3.5 billion deficit. Well, as a state, you can't deficit spend. You know, we have to balance the budget every 2 years. So this forced the conversation. You couldn't do the same things in education, in public safety, or in healthcare. So it really gave us a great opportunity to say, listen, if you're going to sit here and defend the current healthcare system, then you're going to be defending a lot of inefficiency in a lot of ways. So in our budget, we actually targeted a certain number that said, hey, we believe we should be able to achieve a certain number of savings if we better integrated behavioral, physical health, if we were able to reduce high-end utilization. And we put that number in there. Now you can imagine, that scared a lot of folks, but it actually started to drive the conversation in a different direction. Because at the end of the day, states always fall back on these three levers. You're going to cut people, cut rates, cut services, and do it over and over and over again with the same results. We play this game of hot potato with those costs, and we shift them all to the private sector. So we really didn't want to be forced into that box and have a fool's choice. So we really were looking at what are our alternatives, even from a Medicaid budgeting perspective. And you guys know this as well as anybody, but you know, I think one of our big pieces has been, what is the value proposition that we should be driving towards? And if it is actually towards, you know, improving health, then we've got to get out of this, you know, 10% sliver up there. We've got to look at how do we, again, realign those incentives to get us to looking at a more holistic approach. So, you know, our fourth path, our fourth lever, was looking at this. I mean, truly, how can we get there in terms of reducing waste, improving efficiency, and realigning those incentives, and doing so in a way that put us on a sustainable fiscal path. That was absolutely crucial. And it has been crucial even as we are now developing budgets for our expansion populations as well. So we chose this way, and I think much of it had to do, no question in my mind, had to do with the governor's vision and just really making this strong, strong case. We had an amazing public process. So once we kind of released this budget, from that moment on, we had legislators, stakeholders from across the state, from about a group of about 50 meeting weekly to start to put the meat on this and to create more of a straw man of what a potential piece of legislation was going to look like. I can't emphasize this next piece enough for us, where it says bipartisan support. You see those big votes up there. And this is a time, so in 2011 and 2012, we had two big healthcare reform bills that allowed us to move all of this forward. At the time, our House of Representatives was evenly split, 30 Republicans, 30 Democrats. And we had a vote of 59-1 and 53-7. So the message that we had resonated. I will admit I'm the one Republican on the governor's administration, helping kind of lead on the healthcare front. So if I'm sitting down to a Republican or a Democrat, it doesn't matter. I mean, our message is, you know, how are you going to get better value for the healthcare dollars you're spending? And actually, how can you be held accountable to improving health outcomes, and how can you actually get on a sustainable fiscal path? So that this has been, you know, an essential piece for us. So I think even, you know, many times when we're, you know, watching the D.C. debate, you know, we do kind of scratch our heads to think, you know, it just seems kind of crazy to us because we know, we feel like there is a pathway. And trust me, we've got, you know, the extremes, you know, all across. We have from Tea Partiers to, you know, folks who, you know, want to cover everything with no fiscal limits. So I mean, we feel like you've got to find that proper balance and take that policy into this political world, which you think is absolutely essential. I'm going to touch on this a little bit more in terms of this federal waiver. But the big thing that got news, obviously, was the $1.9 billion upfront investment from the feds over a five-year period. I'm going to kind of get into that in a little bit more detail. So we now have 15 what we're calling CCOs, Coordinated Care Organizations. We certainly would never call them ACOs, to be confused with what the feds are doing. But there certainly are some similarities, but I would say there are some differences. I think, you know, the scope of our CCOs are a little bit bigger when you talk about on the Medicaid front, really the full continuum of care. I'll get into that a little bit more. In a very simplified nutshell, I mean, this is really what we have been driving at when we talk about really the attributes of a new type of care model. So that top left, you know, how are you going to better integrate and coordinate services? How are you going to do that within a global budget that grows at a fixed rate? How are you going to be held accountable to specific outcome metrics? And then how can you do all of this within some local accountability and flexibility within your local delivery systems? That's it. What we're starting to drive at is, you know, we're taking our first steps with Medicaid, but as, you know, Ani and others are trying to do as well, how do you start to build that out? I mean, that's really kind of the next big step. Because I, after having been on the health delivery side, the one of the most frustrating things was having to deal with multiple initiatives from multiple payers, which is going to drive up my overhead and be extremely difficult to manage. So now, as we're taking these first steps, it's been really interesting as we're having, you know, conversations with the Nikes and the Intels of the world to say, yeah, why wouldn't we want to do the same thing and get better alignment? So, again, just a briefer summary, you know, with our CCOs, again, similar on that ACO front, but really the full continuum of care. And we had had high penetration in managed care within our Medicaid program for many, many years. Well over 85%. But the problem was we had done so in a very fragmented way. So we had silos for physical health, silos for mental health, silos for dental health. So you could be one Medicaid enrollee enrolled in multiple plans with basically no coordination. So that has now gone away. So all of that really is structured under one umbrella within each respective community. So as I said, we have 15 that really got up and running back in August of last year. Right now, we're about 93, 94% of our Medicaid population is enrolled in a CCO. So what does this look like from the federal side? We had a waiver that became effective in July. This was kind of an unbelievable time frame. We passed legislation in February of 2012. We submitted our waiver the next week in early March, and we got approval in July. Now, part of that had to do with us working hand-in-hand with CMS for the previous year and a half. So once they knew we had our initial legislation, I mean, every month we were working with them kind of in concert in terms of what this CCO model would look like in terms of global budget, in terms of services, and that was an essential piece of getting this through. The other big thing was just having new flexibility. You guys have read the articles in the New York Times, the Washington Post, and yes, we do make fun of our boss sometimes about the air